It's probably not difficult to recall a time growing up as a child when you played in a muddy patch of ground, perhaps driving toy trucks through the soil, or making mud pies in small, colourful buckets. Add a hosepipe or a full watering can into the mix, and you are no doubt in your element. Some people just never said goodbye to that way of life. The patch of ground and the toys may be bigger, but in a lot of ways, what you see on Wine Vignen Velen is no different. Since the end of the last century, the Brecon Beacons National Park Authority has embarked on an ambitious project to restore an area of rare bogland that covers roughly the same size as 15 rugby pitches. Yet not even the hardiest supporters of the oval ball would fancy playing 80 minutes on this ground. No one knows for sure why the bog started to erode, but the most commonly heard theory suggests fires ravaged this remote upland area decades ago, and plants have struggled ever since to grow back on the thick layer of bare peat that has taken thousands of years to form. As you will soon find out, every time it rains, there is a frost, or the wind blows. Not only is peat lost from this moor, but also carbon is released into the atmosphere, contributing to climate change. During this podcast, you will hear how the National Park Authority is turning Wine Vignen Velen from black to green.
Very easy just to look at the landscape and just think, well, this is how it's always been. I mean, we always see a landscape like this as being a natural and very uninterfered with landscape, but I mean, that couldn't actually be further from the truth.
I mean, if we were to go back in time, sitting in this spot here, 20,000 years ago, we'd have been probably under several hundred foot of ice at the height of the last ice age. Eventually, of course, the climate improved, things warmed up, the ice melted away, and this landscape was probably at its wildest then, 15 or 18,000 years back, just bare rock, strewn with boulders, first few mosses perhaps starting to invade the area, and then, you know, hard on the heels of those sort of pioneering plants, you got animal life, and then eventually people came in as well. And bit by bit, the land greened. But it's been a process of change all the way through those thousands of years. Wine Vignen Velen now, of course, is an area of peat, but it was this open body of water. And I guess our distant ancestors, you know, found that an attractive place to come in the landscape, probably for very practical reasons. I mean, they're obviously looking for food and shelter, but also perhaps they, like us, they came here for spiritual reasons as well.
We know that there were people up here. I mean, I've found evidence myself of flints in the bog while I've been working up here, and they've been dated as being between 6,000 and 3,500 BC. The flint itself is quite an insignificant small piece of flint, about an inch by an inch. You can see the nicks on it where it's been shaped to be turned into a tool. That was their lifeline, if you like. That was their tool for cutting animal skins or whatever it was they used it for, just to help them survive up here all those many years ago. The flints stand out so much because we're on a limestone seam here, and you wouldn't get flints up here. The only way you'd get a flint up here is if someone had brought it up here.
So, I mean, one of the things that always strikes me is the fact that you've got a bog here right in the middle of the limestone belt of country.
I would expect people not to understand what an earth bog means. The bogs we're talking about are great big blankets of preserved vegetation rolling out for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of square kilometres across large parts of Wales and so on.
And it is odd. I mean, just standing on the edge of the bog here, there's plenty of peat all around me. And yet only, you know, 20, 30 metres away, there's fragments of limestone pavement. So certainly that limestone will extend under my feet here. And there are fractures and there are cracks going down into the cave system below. We're in a natural hollow. It makes sense that the natural hollow must have been smeared with clay originally. Again, you know, this is a legacy of the passing of the ice across the area. And that layer of clay has acted as a seal so that water doesn't escape too rapidly. And that's why the lake was here for a while, and why we've had a wet bog here as well.
I think the most agreed on theory as to how the bog had become so degraded is through wildfire. And then following that, it was sheep grazing.
And you just, there was just so much evidence of any fresh green cotton grass being about the only thing that you could eat out there, and that just being nibbled out or pulled out or kicked out. And then obviously the sheep would come down there because of a nice warm surface in a cold area, and all that nice dark surface heating up nicely. So they'd lie on the peat, they'd rub their fleeces on the peat and so on. So all those actions were just, you know, just making it impossible for any sort of vegetation recovery to occur there.
Below us, we've got Danarogov show caves, and it was brought to our attention that the water running through was getting really, really discoloured. When you see a river that comes from the mountains after a big storm, it's always quite orange, and that was happening down in Danarogov. And also, there was a lot of rapid cave formations going on down there. And we thought initially that perhaps the cave expansion was causing erosion up on the bog, and changes in drainage patterns were causing the erosion up here. After working on this project for a while, we realised that it was the other way around. So all that acid in the peat was flowing down into the caves, and because it's all limestone, it was just eroding it all away.
The hollows and the dips and the holes, they get called a variety of things, sinkholes, shakeholes, swallow holes. Basically, it's where the ground has collapsed after the water has washed away the limestone underneath the ground, and it's caused these hollows.
They're all depressions in the ground. Usually the word shakehole is reserved for the ones that are dry, and a swallow hole is one, a shakehole that's got a stream flowing into it. All of that empty space is rock that has been dissolved away or collapsed away underground.
And we're working quite closely with the South Wales Caving Club and the Danarogov Caving Committee as well to try and understand what's happening underground. They've been looking at, you know, where the water goes, for example, what the pathways are.
The runoff from the peat bog at Wijnvegen and Vellen runs into a boulder area which lies against a cliff face. The only known major resurgence was Danarogov, so it was a fair bet that it would be going there, and eventually it was dye-tested and shown to be.
Here on our doorstep is the opportunity for original exploration, possibly one of the few places left on this planet where we can do it. Most of the jungles have been explored, all of the mountains have been climbed. There have even been 12 people on the moon.
First excavations went down to about 30 or 40 feet, shattering as they went and removing all spill. But the work that was done in the early 1960s only stopped when the long crawl was passed in Danarogov, which meant there was really no point in looking for a more complicated way in. The way in had been found.
Some places in the long crawl, it is still basically the same size as I am.
Well, it's probably only about couple of hundred feet, but you know, it can take a hell of a long time. And I have on one occasion had to bring a bloke out because he couldn't get round a right angle bend, and his long bones in his leg were too long to negotiate. You know, he just jammed.
The cave management allow access for cavers provided they are accompanied by a conservation warden in Danarogov, and the way into the rest of the natural cave is past the what's called the balcony at the end of the show cave, and you descend from there down to the active river passage and have to cross what are called the lakes, which are four deep water areas in the natural river passage. And at the far end of that, you then climb up into the fossil passages, and you're away into the rest of the series. There are 15 kilometres of passage altogether in there that are known about today.
And when we got to the long crawl, we were actually functioning on just my sidelight. In those days, there was a telephone cable, an armoured telephone cable running through the long crawl, so we actually went out without any lights at all so that we could economise, just feeling our way along with the cable and the fact that we knew the passage. It brings it home to you just how helpless you would be.
A fossil passage is all cave passage that no longer carries a running stream. You can see fossils in the rock, but they're not plentiful.
In the far end of Danarogov are some of the most immense banks of mud, stratified in various ways. The water level cuts down through the limestone, so eventually these banks of clay and gravel are left high and dry and are not disturbed. They would be broken up by rain and wind and so on the surface, but they actually contain seeds, small parts of animals, all sorts of remains, which give a true picture of the past in this area, in the same way that muds at the bottom of lakes do.
Those sediments contain much information, much data, which is going to be more and more valuable as time goes by, because the evidence of climate change that they contain.
In this part of Wales, the bogs we have will never be as rich as they are in North Wales, and the bogs in North Wales will never be rich and spectacular as they are in Scotland. The ones in Scotland won't ever be as rich and spectacular as they are in Scandinavia and so on, and they probably won't be as rich and spectacular as they are over in Siberia. So there's, if you like, there's a hierarchy of wonder. But that's not to say these bogs aren't good or aren't potentially very good, because they are. They're the only place you find that combination of cotton grasses and deer grasses and different sorts of heather and sphagnum mosses and things like sundews and so on, which people love to see sundews because they're a carnivorous plant. So people are fascinated by the fact we actually have something that, you know, behaves a bit like a Venus flytrap.
The restoration of the bogs being done primarily because we are, at the end of the day, a national park, and we are here to protect the landscape. The landscape is the important feature of this national park. We could have just left this and said, oh, it's a natural phenomenon, just let it get on with it. But, you know, I think over time, if we hadn't stepped in, then that would have been a great loss. Ultimately, the fences that are around there will come down, and that area that we've restored and, you know, protected now will be just like any other bit of hill up here.
Thankfully, we had a bit of a windfall of cash as a consequence of the King Arthur film starring Clive Owen and Ray Winstone and Keira Knightley. They needed to do a bit of filming of the opening scenes, so we got a dollop of cash. Just the right amount of money to buy a fence, and that was the single most important thing we did. And the Black to Green Pod project started at that point. When we had a fence, we had a controllable area that we could exclude livestock from. And that straight away made a difference, because you could already begin to see the seed fall from the cotton grasses and the adjacent intact vegetation falling onto the peat. You could see that grass was taking hold and it was staying put and it wasn't being kicked out. The grass was able to take hold in the bare peat and carry on growing. We knew we didn't necessarily have a problem with enough available nitrate. So that gave us heart straight away.
The site itself, once you stumble across it or find it, it's the only fenced off area that you'll see on the hill.
Obviously, turning black peat back to a green, revegetated surface. That was really inspired by the fact that we were cutting gorse from another common purely to improve the grazability of that common. But we had basically a spare product, a waste product, the gorse mulch. I suggested that we should move that from one part of the park to another. It's free. The only cost is in the bagging it up and transport. And then use it in some way, shape or form, on Wyon Vignan Velen. So we tried it. I can only take my hat off to the team for flying these bags of gorse mulch. Hundreds of them. Massive operation, massive undertaking.
We've obviously done a number of airlifts up here, and I think the whole Western Area team have come quite professional, if you like, at dealing with airlifts and expecting, you know, knowing what to expect when we're doing airlifts. But occasionally we still get caught out. There's been a couple of amusing instances up here. There was the time when one of the wardens, who will remain nameless, Rex and I were up here doing an airlift of the heather bales. The heather bale was to come in with my direction, and Rex was meant to come in and unhook the heather bale. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, Rex didn't see this heather bale, huge heather bale, coming underslung this very noisy helicopter. So he didn't see it and he didn't hear it coming. And unfortunately, poor old Rex was knocked off his feet by this huge heather bale and landed in the peat. And I don't know if you're familiar with the snow angels, and it looked like Rex was trying to do a mud angel in the peat. But it was a very amusing minute to watch Rex being knocked off his feet by this pendulum of a heather bale coming around and knocking him down like a skittle.
It would be untrue to say we haven't had our detractors within the National Park staff about the use of helicopters. So we've done some calculations on the amount of peat that we'd be prevented from being eroded and the amount of carbon that contains. And the maths comes out very strongly in favour of using helicopters, because, yes, they emit carbon in their journeys, but we are conserving an awful lot more carbon within that peat through the work that we're doing, so that the cost benefit really works in favour of continuing to use helicopters.
And because it is so far from anywhere, the bags are so heavy, we wouldn't be able to walk them up, God forbid. So they're dropped onto the site and we then tip them upside down, get the gorse out and just use forks to spread the gorse over the bare ground.
We found that you could spread it quite thinly and it would just sit down there. It was heavy enough not to be blown around too much, and because it's quite spiky, it would actually, well, like Velcro, stick itself to the peat quite well as well. And obviously, being a legume, as gorse is, it comes with its own nitrogen source as well, so you can't ask for more than that, which is again why the grass seeds have kicked off so well in it.
And you do have to question why on earth anybody would want to volunteer to come up here and stand knee deep in peat and help us shuffle gorse around, but they have. And I think that's incredible, the dedication that some people have. You know, they've come up here, they've braved all weathers, all voluntarily, just to help out with this project. And it's, you know, I think that's fantastic.
We've walked a bit further onto the bog now, into the area where some of these gullies get really deep. And if I was to stand in the bottom of one of these, I'd be sort of like pretty dwarfed by the depth and the size of these gorges that have been carved out of the peat by the runoff of the water.
The next phase is going to be dealing with the gullies, because some of these gullies, I mean, there are dozens of them up there. The very biggest ones, you could drive an articulated lorry through and you wouldn't see it from a distance, because that's how deep the gullies are and that's how wide they are. You know, they could be 20 metres across at the top and 10 metres wide at the base in places. So what we're going to be looking at is putting dams into those. What we will also be looking at doing is on the upstream side of that, is putting in loads of, you know, more vegetation, maybe heather bales, rolled up vegetation, to intercept the energy, so that by the time that water gets through that vegetation, it's not really hitting the dam. It's just kind of coming up against it and then wearing over the top of it.
One of the things that I found most attractive is when the cotton grass is putting on its show, and particularly in sunshine with a light breeze blowing, and you've got these beautiful little heads of fluffy cotton blowing in the wind. It's such an iconic plant, if you like. It really evokes a sense of place.
I think for us as wardens as well, you know, seeing the cotton grass is a sign of success. When we stand here and the more cotton grass we see, then we realise the more successful the project's been, you know, because that's the plant that colonises and can really spread across the bare peat. And as soon as that's taken hold, we know that there's not going to be any more erosion in those patches.
Before the work was actually carried out in the peat bog, the water was extremely discoloured, a very dark colour coming through the cave. And not only the discoloration in the water, but the staining of the cave formations and the cave walls was quite apparent after a flood. And also when the flood water went away, we were just left with peat inside the cave. So obviously all this had to be cleared away as well, just increasing the workload tremendously on a day-to-day basis.
These bogs also have another function, which is they hold water for us and they improve water quality. An intact peat bog will release cleaner water than a degraded peat bog will. If you want to, for example, reduce the amount of water that runs off the hills and could contribute to an increased risk of flooding in the lowlands, well, one of the best ways of doing that is to stop the water from getting there in the first place, which is to hold it in the hills. The cheapest, most cost-effective way of doing that isn't to build a huge, great flood defences, which then have a maintenance liability forever and a day, and then they have huge engineering costs and energy costs anyway, and can be very disruptive. Spend a fraction of that money by, you know, investing in upland habitat restoration.
For myself, I think part of the motivation for being involved in a project like this is some sort of belief in the future. I'm quite looking forward to bringing my children up here at some point so that they can enjoy it, and Daddy can say, well, he had a small part in this, in the way that it looks today. I think, you know, one of the main responsibilities of our age is the challenge that climate change is, you know, thrusting upon us, and, you know, we each of us need to meet that challenge. This is a very positive way in which we can, you know, do something practical, do something, you know, of substance for the future.
If Wales, for example, was to lose 1% of its organic peat or soil carbon each year, then that contributes an additional 25% to Wales' overall carbon emissions into the atmosphere, which is quite a phenomenal figure.
And if you look on our website, you can actually see pictures of what the bog used to look like, and it's incredible. It's just a massive black expanse of peat. And now there are literally only a few little patches, bare peat left. It's incredible.
It's very striking from memory from the last time you were here to what you're actually looking at now and how green it actually is, and that's why we come up here in those horrible conditions.
I think across the northern hemisphere in particular, there are enormous tracts of peatland, and they act as one of the major carbon stores at the Earth's surface. This small area of bogland in itself probably won't make an enormous amount of difference, but in terms of it being a demonstration of what's achievable, it perhaps has an importance out of proportion to its size.
Our great thanks go to the contributors, who in order of appearance were John Pym, Alan Bowring, Paul Shenadurai, Helen Pye, Walwork for the Brecon Beacons National Park Authority, Mick Day and Colin Bernie Woodley from the South Wales Caving Club, and James Price from the National Show Cave Centre for Wales. This podcast was produced by Audio Trails.